I have to leave sharply at 12:40.
I think so. Huh? This is interviewing Professor Priester on 19th February 1972.
At that time, the Allied forces, which did not permit anything which looked like radar or radio astronomy. And this was lifted when the federal government was created in 1949 or 450, could have been 51, I don't recall the exact times, when all these restrictions were finally lifted on it. So
was there an interest to do this, but you were not allowed to?
We were not allowed to, because this had something to do with military developments, and therefore it was restricted. But
I want to ask one question. Würzburger?
The Würzburg telescope was an old radar radar telescope during the war, and they were all removed. There was nothing left in Germany, unfortunately.
They were instrumental for the Dutch and English and even the Americans.
That's true, and we regretted very much that we didn't have anything left over in here. But in any case, we couldn't have used it. This restricted radio astronomy basically to theory. In 1949, I guess Albrecht Unser, you should try to interview him at Kiel University. You know his name, yeah?
Yes,
otherwise, I take notes with us, and then he was one of the very first. He got interested in it, in particular from his interest on solar physics. He wrote his famous books on physics of stellar atmospheres. And in the second edition of this book, there is also chapter 22, a rather detailed account on the earlier development of radio astronomy. Not too much emphasis on what happened in Germany. There wasn't very much happening, really. But in general, that might be useful to read.
That's in the second edition of
In the second edition of Physics of the Stellar Atmosphere, in chapter 22.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that is useful. Has that ever been translated into English?
I don't think so, no. I know this so well because when Unser started on writing on that chapter, he used one of my detailed notes on it, but he redid it completely on a much more basis of a theoretical physicist, and he is a great man in that respect, certainly. And so I did the proofreading on it and so on. And in that year, there was the... Oh, yeah, but we really have to go back to 1940, when Henye and Keenan in the States tried to explain the what at that time not wasn't known, really, whether it was known thermal or thermal radio emission. At that time, they tried to explain it by pure thermal emission Coulomb-Bremsstrahlung. And then after the war, from the forthcoming measurements of better and better spectra, it became clear that the spectral index was just opposite what you would expect for thermal radiation.
Are you talking to me now about the radio stars?
I'm talking about the background. The radio stars were just discovered in 46, but it took quite a few years till, let's say, till 49, 50, until really a spectra became available. As a matter of fact, it was 50.
Yeah, okay.
And so for the background, it became more and more clear that you got such a steep spectral index, which by no means could be explained by a thermal emission. But nobody at that time, at least not in the Western Hemisphere, thought of, before 1950, thought of any synchrotron mechanism. By the way, 48 was the first time synchrotron emission was observed in a laboratory. Of course, it was known theoretically since 1912 when Scott wrote his famous book on that electromagnetic radiation. But
you say the Western Hemisphere, you're referring to Schlossky's.
I'm referring to now when we really come to the discovery of the synchrotron mechanism. Actually, the initial impulse came from Alfvén's paper, where he tried to explain it by synchrotron mechanism within the solar system. In the physics physical review in 1950, I can give you the exact. Either in the same issue or one or two issues later, there was a famous paper by Karl Otto Kiepenheuer from Freiburg. And I guess that is a man you should interview.
Yeah, and where is he now?
In Freiburg.
He's still at Freiburg.
Freiburg, yeah. In that paper, in a very short paper, he calculated what you would expect from the cosmic ray protons and electrons within the Milky Way in form of synchrotron radio radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up with the answer that if the number of electrons at the same energy interval is the same as the number of protons, you must remember at that time no electrons had been discovered in the cosmic rays. It was only in 1961
when
Vogt and Peter Meyer in Chicago, Vogt in England and Peter Meyer in Chicago discovered the electrons first in the cosmic rays. So under the condition that you had about equal amount of electrons and protons, then you could easily explain the observed background radiation as synchrotron emission from those electrons.
Mm-hmm.
The only trouble at that time was that it was already clear in the cosmic ray physics that the amount of electrons was highly reduced as with respect to the amount of protons. And so there was much hesitance in order to accept these mm-hmm. ideas. And basically, I would say, it was then in 51 was Ginzburg, really, and Slovsky made... it's not really true. By the way, there is a famous paper of Ginzburg where he has all this history from the Russian side in it, in case...
I see.
Let me just see. I believe I have a nebula, which had been identified in 49 by John Bolton.
Right.
And... Then Sklovsky made the prediction that the radiation should be polarized, and then Dombrovsky and some other people, I don't recall the names, in Russia, and at the same time Jan Oort and one of his collaborators, forgotten his name, investigated the polarization.
Right.
And it was only then, in particular when Jan Oort really came up and said this is... really to an appreciable amount is polarized radiation, and that really was a breakthrough for the synchrotron emission.
To be believed.
And this was then almost till 1955, really.
So Kiepenheuer in 51, you say, had put forth a paper with reasonable evidence.
With reasonable evidence, perhaps the unfortunate thing you should ask himself on it is that he based his estimate on the assumption that the number of electrons within the galaxy, far distant
right.
from the Earth, in the galaxy, equal number of electrons to protons at the same energy. And for that there was enough, of course, to do the synchrotron mechanism. And then came Ginzburg with his calculations, where he... I've forgotten what his limit was. I guess he needed about 3%. And at that time, the cosmic ray physicists had evidence that it was less than 1%. It was the upper limit. And this everybody was so hesitant by saying, this is only upper limit. So what?
Yeah.
And finally, it turned out it is 3%. And so all this back and forth, it was a very interesting, exciting time. So now let me come back to Germany. At that time...
But I just want to get on the tape, because the tape wasn't going before. This review of Ginzburg's note, what is your best recollection as to where it might be? And
I've forgotten the book.
It's been translated into English.
It's an English book, yeah. The only Ginzburg paper I have in German is this very first one, which certainly is also in English.
Yeah.
It's on Ospecifix Nauk. This means, reports of the Academy of Science, Fitz Nauk, Physik Nauk, I can't pronounce it in Russian. This is in volume 51, page 343 from 1953. This was a very big first paper by Ginsburg on this.
I still haven't, not quite clear on what he reviewed. Did he review the
No, and this is not a review. This is the original paper.
Not that one, in the other paper.
This is one of the later books he wrote a couple of years ago.
But what did he review? The theoretical?
The history. In the introduction, he reviewed the history of the discovery of synchrotron radiation and all the back and forth from his point of view.
Okay.
He sees it.
I'll find that.
Yeah, you should find it, because I guess that is essential, because he is one of the leading men in that respect, and he will have the best recollection from his point of view.
This may be mentioned in Schlafsky's book also.
I don't know. It is one of the more recent books.
More recent.
Yeah. The book might be only 3 or 4 years old.
Okay, like you say, so back to Germany.
Now back to Germany 49, so before the Kiepenheuer paper.
Maybe can I just go back yet further? I mean, was there any... I mean, during the war in England and in America, there was...
Oh, during the war, I was a young guy, a soldier in the army. I had nothing to do with science at that time. The only thing I remember is that there have been measurements of... with the Würzburg telescope from the Telefunken company, and the man you should talk to is Professor Franz. I take the name down. Professor Franz, he was in charge in Telefunken Ulm. He was in charge of radar development at that time during the war, and they made a survey, a rough survey of the background radiation, which had never been published because it was all under military restrictions, and I don't know whether anybody really has anything left of it, so that can be considered as...
But they were aware of cosmic...
They were aware of that there was something. Of course, it was since 1932, when Jansky had discovered it, it was well known and went through all the newspapers at that time.
But specifically, did they know about the solar radiation? Because, you know, of course, you know about Hay.
Yeah, I know about that.
Jamming, they thought
that I'm not so sure, really.
I guess
sure.
He would be the person to answer that. Is he still active in that company?
He is in the retirement age probably now, but certainly he will be traceable from the company. He was still a big boss of the laboratory on a scientific level, so he didn't have to do much with management, but more with science. And I'm sure he's still active on it.
He'd be good to talk to, yeah.
Unfortunately, the man you should have talked to, this is Professor Leo Brandt. He was also boss of those laboratories during the war. He died a year ago, and there is no way to trace things, except there was a little book which we published in about 10 years ago, and he wrote a chapter on it, and he usually wrote a chapter on this history, because that was an exciting time of his life when these things came, development of the Würzburg telescope and so on, and there might have been some hints as far as radio astronomy is concerned.
I'm
just trying to recall, it was one of those little books I wrote a chapter in it too, I've forgotten completely.
Let's just describe this book in case
It is a little booklet. I've forgotten even the name of it.
About 10 years ago. In German only.
It is in German, certainly. Yeah.
And it's a review.
It's more than 10 years ago. It must have been in 56, 57, 58. At that time, in 56, we started to build the 25-meter dish at the Stockholm Mountain, and. I came to Bonn in 55, on the 1st of July, when we selected the site for this telescope to be built. And the very first day when I came here, I had to be decided this is the center point of the telescope, and I had to hold the wooden pole. Wow. And the boss of the observatory at that time, Friedrich Becker, hit it with a hammer. And this was my first thing in radio astronomy in Bonn. But before that, I was at Kiel with Unsert.
Okay, well, let's get about the book, though. The book had a review of astronomy with different people writing different chapters.
It was a small booklet, really. And
And the chapter that were of interest was
the title of the book was about radar.
I see.
It was not on radio astronomy, it was on radar.
And this fellow, what was his name?
That is Professor Leo Brandt.
Had a chapter in there.
He had a chapter in it, yeah. This man, Leo Brandt, was very vital for the development of radio astronomy in Bonn, because at that time he was Secretary of State in the state of North Rhine-Westphalia in the science. This is a complicated thing. In economy and science, there was a complicated setup. And since he originally was a laboratory boss at Telefunken Labs during the war, and very much interested in radar, and after the war, when he became a politician, he also had, of course, the nice recollection on radar development, mm-hmm. radio astronomy, got so excited, and we got the telescopes.
Nice.
And even for the big 100-meter telescope, he was very vital in that respect, too, which unfortunately by now is forgotten. Most of the people in the Max Planck Institute, they wouldn't even know his name.
This is going back many years, so.
Not many years. He died 2 years ago.
I see.
And with regard to when we just make a jump in time, in 1961 he promised us 35 million marks for building a 100-meter dish. And then, unfortunately, we got an election and a different government, He had the wrong party book. And also he became sick, he had cancer, and he died of cancer 2 years ago now. And so all the 35 million went down the drain for quite a few years, and so finally we managed then to persuade the VW Foundation to leap into the gap.
Let's go back now.
Let's go back to 49.
This is when the military restrictions were lifted.
I don't recall the exact time when this happened, but it must from 46 to 52, I studied astronomy with no context to radio astronomy at Göttingen. And in 53, early 53, after my PhD, I went to Kiel to Professor Unzelt as an assistant. And at Kiel, there had been a very small development of radio astronomy. There was a telescope, which was an array, a tiltable and movable array, all on wooden frame, mm-hmm. of 5 by 5 meters. And when I came to Kiel, Unzelt asked me whether I would be interested to take over together with one of the electronic engineers, this sort of telescope, and to do something reasonable with it.
What frequency was it operating?
That was on 200 megahertz. And so the only thing I could think of to do is to do a survey of the whole sky. And the very fortunate thing was that C.W. Allen and Colin S. Gumm in Australia, mm-hmm. 2 years or 3 years earlier, had made also very crude, with very limited means, even cruder than the telescope we had at Kiel, a survey at 200 megahertz of the southern hemisphere. So this gave then the idea to complete it with the northern hemisphere, with mm-hmm. as much overlapping as possible, and to make a survey of the whole sky,
mm-hmm.
which I thought is a reasonable thing to start then theory with. Unfortunately, we never got
to the theory for some reasons. I'll tell you later.
And the outcome of this is, this is a new one now. This is the old one. This is the Wilibinsky one at 140 megahertz. Let me see whether I still have a... This is another one. And there was another paper in 54, during the solar eclipse. There was a solar eclipse with a central line going through southern Sweden.
Right.
And in Kiel it was about a 95% eclipse.
Uh-huh.
And then we made solar observations with the eclipse and so on, and derived the ellipticity of the solar corona at that time. But I don't think that this paper had any real significance
the point in that respect is that
was the sky survey published in Zeitschrift für Astrophysik also?
Yes, it's in Zeitschrift für Astrophysik. It was finally published in 1956, because we had lots of, at that time you must recall there was no computer, and we had to solve the two-dimensional convolution integral by hand. And with some tricky means we succeeded with it. We get to it. This is the survey of this 200 megahertz survey, which came out in volume 40 in 1956.
Right.
And this is our portion of the sky, and then we combined it with Allen and Gumm, and this is the final. This is also published in the Handbook of Physics in the chapter written by John Oort. There's the same picture is in that.
This is the only place in English.
In Krauss' book. In Krauss, you must recall, at that time it was still in the old galactic coordinate system, L1, LB1.
Right.
And Krauss, in his book on radio astronomy, is one which came out a couple of years 66, ago, 66, redid it and changed the coordinate system to the new coordinate system. It was only recently that I discovered he had changed the coordinate system. It's about 1.5 degrees here. And we were so proud at that time that we could see, here you can see it better, that it was good enough to see that the central line here was tilted with respect to the L1 V0, V10 equator by 1.5 degrees at that time. But if you see the telescope, I'm sorry, I should have a picture of it. I should really have one. In the Zeitschrift für Astrophysik in those years, either in front of that one, there is a picture of the telescope at that time, which is, it was so extremely cheap, you know. The whole budget of that institute, the theoretical institute, I guess, was 10 marks a month for buying pencils and so on. So we usually bought our own pencils. This is unbelievable nowadays. And the whole telescope was built just for nothing. There are other papers on these early times.
Do you have extra copies of these?
Yeah, this is unfortunately, I believe, they are all my latest. So, but we can make Xerox copies easily on that. No, this is later stuff. Let me just see whether I find. This is on the. This is already done here in Bonn. That's later on. This is my thesis now. This is other stuff. And I never came now to the point, going back to 49, when there was no thought of synchrotron radiation. No one tried to explain what could it be, all this seemingly known thermal radiation. And at that time, Albrecht Unzel had the idea that there could be perhaps in the order of 10 to the 10 radio stars, late type stars, which had an atmosphere of activity around, producing effects like solar activity, and to explain the background by the unresolved large number of sources. And in 49 he wrote a paper on that. And in 54, in another paper, I still resumed this theory and made it a little bit more detailed, and came up with the conclusion that you had really to have very strange conditions on those late-type stars. They should have had corona, active corona around on the order of 10 million kilometers. I've forgotten the details at that time from that paper. And but under those conditions, it could have been possible.
But this was already then mixing together at the same time when the synchrotron idea came forward. But even in 61 or 62, Dennis Chalmers in Cambridge still redid the old radio star theory to explain the background, and still refined it more. And when we met in New York at that time, I was at the Space Studies Institute, Bob Jastrow's Institute at that time, and he was there for half a year or so. And when he explained this to us, he tried to find a very a small road to get away with that theory. And I told him I don't think that you really can get away with it. But he had managed to find a very, very tiny road to get through under those conditions you could expect it that way.
Well, tell me now, during the early 50s when you were doing the survey and so forth, you were fully aware of the radio astronomy work going on in other countries?
Oh, sure, yes, yeah. Of course.
So I guess it was only in the late 40s when people didn't know about other groups.
Yes, no, of course. During the war, there was not much this you should ask one of the older scientists. Really. I still believe that the astrophysical journal still came through during the war via Sweden in some tricky way.
I see.
So the astrophysical journal, probably with perhaps half a year delay or something like that, but still came through. So they may, or monthly notices, I don't know. But UNSERT will certainly know all the details.
Okay.
And I urge you really to go to Kiel and interview him on it.
Yes,
I'm sure he will be excited, and give him my best regards.
That
might help to introduce you. And also with Carl Otto Kiepenheuer, you should.
Well, I have some notes here that by 1950 there were three groups that were involved in radio astronomy: Unsold at Kiel, Kiepenheuer at Freiburg.
Yeah, he wrote only this one paper and then decided to build a solar radio astronomy group in Freiburg.
Right, but now I actually have the date 1944 for Kiepenheuer at Freiburg.
No,
as being involved in radio astronomy.
51 as Kiepenheuer.
Okay, well,
the paper on synchrotron radiation is in FISREF in 1951.
Right, but
in 1950. That I can look up easily.
But so there was nothing going on. I couldn't believe this 1944 date.
No,
there was nothing going on at that time.
I never said 1944.
Well, this came
except
you didn't say it. No,
for the Telefunken measurements. They have been done during
right.
the war.
But Kiepenheuer wasn't involved with that.
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think
okay.
so. Let me think. I should find that in my notes on. I can give you the Alfvén Herlofsen and Kiepenheuer paper. It's first review in case of Alfvén and Herlofsen, 78, page 616, 1950. And the paper by Carl Otto Kiepenheuer is in first rev 79, page 738, also in 1950.
Okay, good.
And that was based on the assumption that the number of electrons, number of protons was the same, at the same energy level.
It seems like you've been doing some recent
No, this is my class notes.
I see.
My class notes.
But you're going back a ways still.
Huh?
You're going back a ways still.
Of course, when I talk about synchrotron radiation, then I have to tell these very basic papers just as a reference to it. So.
But now there was one other group that I had that existed, and this was someone, G. Thiessen, in Hamburg. Do you know anything about that?
He died, yes, but I don't think he did make any radio astronomy.
Well,
he was a solar physicist and solar magnetic field and so on. He worked on the solar magnetic field, but I don't think anything on radio astronomy. Of course, there was also the large group at Berlin Adlershof under Otto Hachenberg, who sits right here. Have you seen him already?
No, I haven't talked to him.
But that is something you should.
Now, was he involved in radio astronomy?
Oh, yeah, he had a big installation in East Berlin on radio astronomy.
And what time was that?
I don't know when he started on it, but it must have been around 1950, or perhaps earlier than that. Mm-hmm. And there was even a big radio telescope, 36-meter dish, built in the 36-meter dish must have been built around 1955. Prior.
Yeah, I don't have pictures. I have slides of all this stuff.
Now, were almost all of these...
And then in 1961, when the Berlin Wall was built, Hachenbeck came over to Bonn. And this is the 36-meter dish in Adler's Hof.
Oh, yeah.
And there is a very nice survey, which unfortunately is only published in German, a special journal of the Adler's Hof Heinrich Hertz Institute, and 600 megahertz survey, which unfortunately has never been extensively used for analyzing.
Done with that dish?
Done with that dish, yes. I thought it's one of the finest I've ever seen in, for that time, it was about 5 years ago or so.
But this is something I want to ask you, is are most of the scientific results published in the Zeitschrift for Astrophysics?
Yeah, at that time we still published everything in German.
Right.
The only reason why we did it is I never learned English at school.
That's okay, but I just wanted
to... I learned Latin, ancient Greek and French, and that has no use in science, and so we were always hesitant to learn to publish in English, because it was such a trouble to do it. Of course, you could read the literature easily, but...
To
write it and to speak it, it was terrible.
So, I mean, in any case, this is the way to follow the published record, is to look through...
To look through the astrophysics in case you really want it. I don't think there is any real major contribution to radio astronomy you can find in that. And there's no paper with a big breakthrough or so, and except if you really say this paper by Kiepenhauer was the first thing to point out what the real synchrotron mechanism was.
Unserl's
attempt with the radio stars is, from the historical point of view, is certainly of interest. The survey of the 200 megahertz survey, which was the only survey of the entire sky for 16 years, from 1956 till 1972, when Richard Wilibinski came up with a 150 megahertz survey. There is no other survey of the whole sky. There are many, many, many surveys of details, but nothing which covers the whole sky, because you have to have cooperation from Australia here. Huh? And apparently this is not so easy to establish unless you really have people traveling back and forth and doing here and there.
That's the usual, right?
Yes, now let me see. Now we lost our...
Well, we're up to your survey, I think, in 53.
In
50, you described that.
Yeah, we made it. The measurements have been made in 19. Let me just think. I came in 53. We started immediately because everything was set all right. 53, 54. Some of the measurements still in 55. It took an awful lot of time to survey it because the telescope couldn't be moved. There was no computer to steer it and so on. The telescope was set at a certain declination in the meridian plane and then let the Earth rotate.
Right.
And so it took an awful lot of time, of course. And angular width of the half width of resolution was 16 degrees. 16. And when we got the measurements, finally, we made this five times the whole sky and then the average of those five measurements and then tried to cross them together. We had also measurements where we moved the telescope 5 degrees every few minutes. I've forgotten the details, it's all in the paper, in order to get across through the survey once. But with a fixed telescope, you get a constant declination, and then you get a scan crossover, and then you try to put that together, and then to solve the convolution integral in such a way that you could improve the resolution power by a factor of 2.
Mm-hmm.
You can't. Of course, if you know exact with absolute accuracy the observation, your antenna characteristic, mathematically, you could solve it in such a fashion that you really get to an infinite resolution power. But in practice, your measurements restrict you, and you can improve by a factor of 2, but not not more than that. And but that was then done, all the solving of the convolutional integral I did already when I was here. I took all the measurements with me, and then.
So you came to Bonn.
I came to Bonn in 1st of July '55. That was exactly the date when we looked for the place and said, here is the point where the telescope will be built, the 25-meter dish. Yes.
So maybe that's a good place to break off.
It's a good place to break off, because I have to be at home at 1 o'clock, okay. Unfortunately. And
so we'll start next time when you're beginning in Bonn.
Yeah, it depends on your plan.
That ends the interview with Wolfgang Priester on 20 February. 73.